So let's have a quick summary of what we've got so far. We've gone through a whole bunch of filters, the NLP presuppositions being very important filters. We had a look at perceptual positions, in particularly the first, the second, the third position. The first is your point of view. The second is the other person's point of view. The third position is a neutral stranger's who has an equally positive disposition to both of you, observing the same event. And from each position, gain new perspective, new insight to the situation. You understand it from a very different, in a different way. Then we looked at chunking, and chunking in terms of how you provide information, what level of information do you look at. Chunking is also often followed by sequencing. In other words, how do you present information? So I can say the word, the dog chases the cat, or I can change the sequence and say the cat chases the dog. By changing the sequence, I've changed the meaning. So chunking and sequencing is basically a way of controlling the meaning of something by looking at what level of information do you give it and in what order do you give that information in order for it to have a certain effect on someone else. Make sense?
Yeah, sure.
So let's turn now onto something that NLP is particularly famous for, which is to do with the sensory modalities. We have basically five senses, five modalities in which we can experience the world. We've got sight, sound, feeling, taste, and smell. Each of those modalities, each of those senses, gets processed in a part of the brain. And for a lot of them, for example, sight and sound and touch, there are specific parts of the brain that are dedicated to processing that information. In fact, different types of sight and different types of touch will also be processed in unique areas as well. But that's overcomplicating the picture for the moment. What is interesting is the idea that NLP presents that different people will favor a particular system. So some people are very oriented towards the visual system. They like things that they can see. So if you show them lots of charts and paint them pretty pictures, they'll get more convinced than if you list a long litany of ideas to them. Some people like to feel things, so they need to be able to hold on to something and touch it and feel it and sense it and all those kind of senses. So the three senses that dominate are the visual, the auditory, and the kinesthetic. Some people like to see things, some people like to hear the information, some people like to feel and get involved with information. Each one of those, again, will have, because of the different style, will need different kinds of learning environments, will need different ways of being exposed to the information. And by learning environment, by the way, I include therapy as a learning environment, I include sales as a learning environment, I include running a business as a learning environment. Some people are hands-on. Guess what that means? They're going to go in there and they feel it. They're not going to be in physical presence. Some people are, they're more auditory, want to be in dialogue, they want to discuss things with others. People who are more visual may want to see the charts, they might want to see it represented graphically or in a picture. You want to create a mental movie of the outcome so they can perceive it inside of their senses at a level where it's satisfying to them. Why are these three senses important? Well, to a certain extent, because you want to change the activity that the person engages in according to their system. So doing a sales presentation to kinesthetic people, you want to give them little samples for them to hold and to look at, maybe to play with. If they're auditory, you might want to give them a whole list of information and just rattle it off. If they're visual, you probably want to have lots of slides and maybe have the models there as well that they can look at. And you want to paint them a picture of how people are using it and people are buying it. So you're already understanding that. It helps you understand what level of information to give priority to when you're dealing with people. But in NLP, there are three additional ways to use this idea that are particularly intriguing. The first one has to do with language. Now, if people tend to predominate either in visual, auditory, or kinesthetically in the systems, the idea is that this gets expressed inside the language. If your uppermost thought is visual things, you'll speak in visual terms because that's how you're thinking. So your language will tend to describe what's going on inside your brain. So a visual thinker will use lots of visual words like, I see your point. Can you draw me a picture? It's all a blank to me. It's like a gray fog. These are all visual terms, which is an indication that this person is currently thinking a lot in pictures, making pictures inside their minds. Now, an auditory person might say things like, that sounds great. It rings a bell. It doesn't ring a bell. It's a bit off. There's a disharmony in the room. What are they saying? Well, they're talking about auditory terms so that their language reflects auditory ideas. They're using auditory predicates, like hearing, like sound, like bells, like harmony, harmonics, etc. The kinesthetic type will tend to lean on kinesthetic words. Get a firm grip on yourself. Pull yourself together. I can't grasp up. Let's touch base. These are all kinesthetically loaded words. And again, it's an insight into the way that this person is thinking, because they tend to be thinking more in kinesthetical terms. Now this has, by the way, before we go any further on this, let me just emphasize. Most people will be conversant in all forms of thinking so that their language will also reflect this, so that they'll be using a little bit of visual, a little bit of auditory, a little bit of kinesthetic. It's just that we'll tend to use one more than the others, and that tends to be their dominant system, the one that they prefer. It's called the preferred system or the primary system, because they just prefer using it. It doesn't mean that they're stuck on it. It doesn't mean that that's the only thing that they can do. It just means that they prefer information in that system, and that it tends to help them to have information in that system in order to be able to understand something. The other thing to realize is that this can also change across contexts. For example, someone in their family life with their family might be very kinesthetic and touchy-feely, but in the office or at work, they might be very cold and distant. They might be very visual or very auditory. So just because someone in one environment behaves in one particular way, don't assume that it will be true across the board. You always take people as they come, and you always take them in accordance with the environment that they're interacting with. Now, the reason that the VAK, visual, auditory, K, and kinesthetic language connection to the way they're thinking is important is because it allows you to adjust your communication, allows you to adjust it so that you start reflecting back onto them the kind of words that they like to hear. You can do that literally by reflecting the actual words they're using. You can also do that in a more subtle way by using more of the kind of words that are in the system, in other words, the sensory modality that they like. So if someone's very visual and they say, I see your point, you know, draw me a picture, you know, the future is bright, bright being, of course, a modality or a submodality of vision, then you start using similar terms, you know, have a look at this, I'll see you soon, let me draw your picture here. At that point, you are presenting information in such a way that will slip through their filter more smoothly, because that filter is designed to let that kind of information in. Does it mean you can't use other type of language? Absolutely not. It just means that the other type of language may not be perceived as easily by them. It'll be harder for them to grasp, which is the kinesthetic term, of course. It'll be harder for them to see your point. Or it'll be harder for them to harmonize with the ideas that you're creating. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, it does.
So an interesting exercise to do is to just go out there and just to listen in your normal conversations to how people are talking. What kind of words are they using? And become particularly sensitive to hearing words, feeling words, and seeing words, and the kind of mix that people use. Again, let me emphasize, you will very rarely come across someone that is exclusively in one system. In fact, I've never come across someone. You will come across people who really dominate in one system, obviously. And you'll more often come across people who are somewhere across the board, and they'll just tend to prefer one over the others. Just listen out for that. It's a very interesting exercise to do. And if you set your internal filters to listening out for that, you'll start noticing a lot more when it does happen. Now, there's another thing that happens, or another implication to this VAK thinking. VAK, by the way, visual, auditory, and kinesthetic, is sometimes known as the four-tuple. The idea being V is one, A is a second, K is a third, and then smell and taste are kind of lumped into a fourth, being a four-tuple. So VAK and then OG, in other words, olfactory and gustatory, taste and smell, are lumped together at the end. That's just a little bit of NLP terminology should you ever come across it. Now, let's turn our attention to another implication to this modal way of thinking, this sensory way of thinking. If it gets reflected inside your language, is there another area that it can come out in as well? Well, according to NLP, yes, there is. NLP talks about I accent cues. If you talk to someone and you ask them a question or you make statements, you'll notice that their eyes will tend to kind of flash around the room as they look around. Now, they're not literally looking around the room unless you're actually pointing out a picture on the wall or something. What tends to happen is that they're looking for information inside themselves, and their eyes kind of make movements across the board in order to try and access the information inside of themselves. So if they go looking for information, if they go trying to hear a sound inside themselves or get in touch with a feeling, their eyes will tend to go into different locations. So as you keep track of these eye movements, you can kind of keep track of what's going on inside the mind. If you like, which room is open inside the mind? Is it the auditory room? Is it the visual room? Is it the kinesthetic room? Now, by keeping track of where their eyes are going, you can also keep track of what information or where the information is stored. If you ask them about a holiday, for example, and they go to the place that they normally go to when they're making pictures, well, then you know that they're probably making a picture again about the holiday. If you are asking about the holiday, though, and they go to the place that they normally, their eyes go to the place they normally go to when they are hearing sounds, well, then they're probably either talking to themselves or maybe they're making sounds and maybe hearing the holiday music or hearing the sound of the ocean, and that helps them get in touch with that sensation. And the same, of course, is true with the kinesthetic. So what are these eye-accessing cues? What are these places where the eyes tend to go to that tells you that the person is making pictures or hearing sounds or having feelings at that point in time? Well, if you look inside your manual at the eye-accessing cues chart, it pretty much tells you what these are. You'll notice that the eyes can basically look up, look from side to side, or look down. And each of those things mean different things. Now, if they look up to the left or up and to the right, it'll again mean different things. If you look to the left on an even horizontal plane or look to the right, again, it means slightly different. And the same is true of looking down to the left and down to the right. There's a seventh position, by the way, which is just looking straight ahead, kind of defocusing. We'll have a look at what all these things mean in a moment. As a rule of thumb, when people are looking up above the horizontal, they tend to be looking for information. In other words, they are making pictures inside their minds or accessing pictures. When people are looking from side to side, they tend to be listening out for things. They're listening for information. Finally, when they're looking down, depending on which way they look, they're either talking to themselves or they're having a feeling or checking in with a feeling. And you can try this out with your friends, by the way. I'll give you a whole bunch of questions you can ask them to test this out for yourself. Now, to make a more of a distinction here, when someone looks up, and imagine there's a person standing in front of you now, and you're talking to them, you're face-to-face having a conversation. So the directions I'm about to give you are all relevant in relation to you looking at that person now, where their eyes go. It's not in relation to themselves. So as you look at that person, if the person is looking up and looks up to the left, it's called visual construct. In other words, they're probably imagining something new. There's something they haven't seen before. If they look up and to the right as you're looking at them, they are probably remembering a picture. This is important again, because if you ask them about something and they remember something, or if you ask them about something and they have to construct it, it tells you about where their experience is at. The same is true of auditory. If they look on the horizontal plane towards one ear, if you look to the left as you're looking at them, in other words, they're looking at their right ear almost, they are tending to construct the information. In other words, they are inventing it. If you look towards the right, they tend to be remembering it. If you look towards the left, they tend to be constructing it. So that's true equally of visual and auditory. Finally, again, look in the axis chart. If they're looking down to the left, they tend to have feelings. If they're looking down to the right, they tend to have what's called auditory digital. In other words, they talk to themselves. It's internal dialogue. Now, by keeping track of these movements, you get a reasonably accurate map of what's going on inside the person at any one point in time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Okay. So you can test this with people by just asking simple questions. For example, what does it feel like to have your hand in snow, in cold, ice-cold snow, right? Now, in order to answer that, people have to go in and remember it. And chances are they'll look down to the left, which means they're having a feeling, the sensation of the cold snow. You might ask them, what does your house look like? Now, if they look up and to the right, they're remembering it. Now, sometimes people will just kind of defocus slightly and answer your question anyway. So for information that people are very familiar with, they can just answer it by just having a quick defocus, and their eyes need to go anywhere because it's just so easily accessible. So that's the seventh position. So they can either look up and to the left or up and to the right, up sideways to the left, sideways to the right, down to the left, down to the right, or straight ahead and slightly defocused. Upwards is visual, sideways is auditory, downwards is either kinesthetic or internal dialogue. Straight ahead tends to be visual, although it can be any of the other things as well. If they're very easy for them to access, they'll just do that very quickly that way. If you ask someone about their favorite bit of music, they'll probably move their eyes to one direction, so as they're kind of hearing it inside their mind again, especially if you ask them to replay it. If you ask them to replay a conversation they had with someone, they'll probably look down and toward the right. So this is something you can do with people and ask them specific questions like, what does your living room look like? What would it sound like if you would whisper in outer space? What would it sound like if an elephant started trumpeting for God Save the Queen? These are all tonal questions you're asking. You can ask them by any kind of sense. Does that kind of make sense so far?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Something interesting might happen if you're doing this. Sometimes, when you ask them a question like, what does your favorite singer sound like? They may look up first and then down to the, and then back to the horizontal and to the side. What do you think just happened then? Remember, you've just asked for an auditory piece of information. You want to know what this sounds like, that's the sound of their favorite singer's voice. So why are they suddenly looking at, go ahead.
Is it because they've just pictured their favorite singer in order to remember what the singer sounds like?
Precisely. So what that tells you is that the information is stored visually. If you imagine that they have a filing cabinet, the filing cabinet where the singer's voice is stored in and all the other information about that singer is stored by their picture of them. So you have to go into the visual filing cabinet, open it up, look at the singer. So now they found the singer, and they'll go, oh, okay, now I can start listening to the recording. So they've looked up, and then they look across and into the horizontal and across, so that it tells you that they made a picture of the singer, and then they can access the actual sound of that singer's voice. So what that tells you is it's called in NLP a lead system. Primary system, so if you ask them what a singer sounds like and they just go across, that's going straight to the information. That's the primary system. If someone's a very auditory person, their primary system is auditory. But if they have to look up and then across to the side to get information which is auditory, it tells you that their lead system is visual. They need a visual cue in order to access the auditory information. Now, that won't be true for everything they do, but it happens to be true for that category, for that specific singer. And probably, if it's true for the singer, it's probably true for all, if not most, singers. In other words, to know what a singer sounds like, first I have to make the picture of that singer and then be able to remember that voice. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Okay, now let's see what happens in a different situation. Let's say you ask someone about their favorite pet, their favorite dog, right? And you ask them, how does it feel to hold your favorite dog? What do you feel like when your dog is there? And then they look up and say to the right, and then tell you it feels great, but they keep looking up whilst they're saying it. What do you think just happened there?
They're imagining what it would feel like to hold their dog, they're not actually remembering.
Well, if they're looking up and to the right, so they're not moving their eyes out, they're just literally up to the right and they stay there, they're probably remembering it all the way through. So they're recalling a picture of the dog,
Oh,
right?
to the right, sorry, yeah. I
Yeah.
was top muddled up on my left, yeah.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's basically as you look at the person rather than in relation to the person. Now, what tends to happen is, think about it. You've asked for kinesthetic information, but they're going up towards a visual place and they're sticking in visual, right? What that tells you is that basically they have something called a synesthesia. Basically, two sen different senses, something they see and something they feel, have kind of melted together and become one unit. So, whilst they are actively looking at something, they're feeling it. And in order to feel it, they have to see it. They can't feel it unless they see it, and when they see it, they feel it. They're one and the same thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure.
Here's a classic situation in which people have a synesthesia. Have you ever heard of a phobia?
Yep.
Now, do you think that when someone sees a dog, they have to go inside, remind themselves, oh, look, there's a dog, don't like dogs, a bit afraid of them, let's have panic now? Or do they see the dog and panic before they even know what's hit them?
I think they panic before they even know what's hit them.
Right? In fact, people can be so good at that that they could be leafing through like a magazine or a photograph where there's a dog in the background. They don't even check it consciously. In other words, consciously, they're not even aware of it. But just because the dog is someone in the background, they get this real terrible sense of unease as something terrible is about to happen. Right? This is an example of a synesthesia. The visual system for this particular idea is so closely linked to the feelings attached to it that by looking at one, they literally trigger the other. Phobia is an example, but then useful examples of it also are, for example, in sports, right? In sports, people have to have, hand-eye coordination. That's called a VK synesthesia. So the same thing that you're doing when you see a dog and feel afraid at the same time, that's a phobia, it's a VK synesthesia, is basically the same thing you're doing when you're playing tennis. You see the ball coming and you know where to put the bat, the racket, and you know at what angle to hold it, and you know at what tension to hold your arm in. You can feel it. You can anticipate how hard the blow is going to be because you've wired the feeling and the sight of the ball coming to you so closely together that they're, for all intents and purposes, one and the same thing. You no longer need to think in between it, you just react, you just respond. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
So now we have an interesting situation. You can track people's thoughts through their eye movements as well as through their language. You can track it in terms of what's going on inside to quite a high level of accuracy. So, for example, when their language mismatches where they're looking at, they're telling you whether they have a lead system, whether they have a synesthesia in place, or whether it's just a normal primary system, right? Incidentally, for eye accessing cues, what I've just described is for what's called a normally organized person. In other words, most right-handed people will have it organized in this way. Left-handed people will tend to be a mirror image. In other words, what was on the left is on the right and vice versa. Visual is still up, auditory is still in the middle, kinesthetic and AD is still at the bottom, but it just tends to flip around. So it makes sense to test people a little bit before you assume which one is which. Now, an interesting thing that comes out of being able to check where the mind's going for information and how it puts information together is something called strategies. For example, how do you know it's time to have a problem? Any ideas?
No.
It's an interesting question, isn't it? I mean, why don't people forget to have problems? We forget all kinds of other things. Why don't we forget good things as well? How come you don't forget how to drive a car? What is going on that means you can do these things? How is it that you dress yourself in the morning? Do you have any idea how you dress yourself in the morning? What do you do? Or
Not
do you just,
consciously, no.
no, you just kind of pick up your clothes and somehow they end up being on you. But you know when you've gone the wrong way. If you put your underwear on the wrong way around, you kind of it just feels wrong and something's right, and you just stop there. You don't stop putting your trousers on. You know you've done it the wrong way around, right? Same if you put the trousers on the wrong way, or if you put your shirt on upside down, or you try your jumper on the wrong way around. You know pretty much right as you start doing it that something's wrong. The way you know this is something called strategies. In other words, your mind goes through a little loop. For every behavior and every thought, it goes through a little loop to figure out what is it meant to do. So a loop might be something like, let's say a shopping strategy. You want to go and buy a new pair of shoes. So the loop might start with the how do you know you don't need that you need a new pair of shoes? There might be a decision strategy first. So you see your old pair of shoes and they're all manky and you see in your mind's eye this shiny new pair of shoes. You put them together and suddenly you realize cleaning them is not going to do the job. You need a new pair of shoes. So you go to the shop and you have this shiny new pair of shoes inside your mind. So that's your first step. You've got a test. You've got something against which you're going to test it. You go in the shop and you might talk to the person and describe to the store clerk the picture you have inside your mind. So you now have an AD quality. You're describing something. You might listen to the shop sales assistant's description. So another AD quality. And now you're going to choose from them something that sounds similar to what's inside your mind. They bring the shoes out, and now you do another test. You test it in comparison to what's been inside your mind. So you see the shoes and you look, are they close to being what's on your mind? If the answer is yes, you buy them. Or you may be going to negotiating the price. Let's say the price is irrelevant for the moment. So if they match the picture inside your mind, you buy them. If they don't match it, you go no, send them back, and you'll go through the whole loop again. You'll describe your shoes again, maybe adding different information. They'll describe to you what other lists of shoes they have, and you'll select between those lists of shoes, and then something comes out, and eventually, hopefully, you'll find the shoe that match, or you decide to exit and say, well, you know what? I won't find the shoes I want in this store. I'm going to another store. What I've just described is a strategy. So you start off with an internal picture. You go towards a shoe shop, and we won't talk about how you know what shoe shop to go to. That's another strategy going on there. You have an AD, in other words, you talk to someone about it. You have an Second AD, in terms of you listening, or you have an auditory response, you're listening to someone talking about what they have. Then you have a visual response, because the person comes back with shoes that they show you. If you have to try the shoes on, you have a kinesthetic element in that chain as well. Then you put all that information together, you test it again compared to the first picture, and that first picture might be how the shoes look, how much they cost, and how they feel, in a combination of all those things together. If it matches, you buy them. If it doesn't match, you reject them, and you start the whole process again. Do you see how that works?
Sure, okay, yeah.
Now, the same is true of people making having problems, creating decisions, anything. We have strategies for everything that we do, otherwise we wouldn't know how to do it. And when you discover what strategy someone's running, well, by just ticking the boxes in the right order, you basically guarantee the outcome. So let's say that I know that your strategy to buy, say, a new laptop is that you first of all have to play with it, then you have to hear lots of interesting, you know, features about it, like facts about it. Then you have to compare it to at least two other laptops that you've played with and had equal facts about. And then you need to read a review by an external party about your laptop, and then you're ready to buy it. Okay? You come in the store, and I say to you, well, you know, read this article, and, you know, here's all this information. You think I'm going to sell that laptop to you? Or it's going to be easy to sell that laptop to you at this point?
No.
Why not?
Because you haven't hit all the strategy points.
Exactly. And more importantly, I've put them out of sequence. I've said, the cat chases the dog. And you're going, that doesn't make sense. I want the dog to chase the cat. So if I know this about you, I need to make sure that when you come in, I say, well, have a look at this laptop. Here, play with it. Do you like that? Sure. Well, let me tell you a little bit about it. Brum. By the way, here's an article. Or if the strategy is that you have to experiment first, you go, here's another laptop. Play with that. Here's some facts about this one. Here's another one. Play with that. Here's some facts about this one. Okay, here's an article you might want to read that compares these laptops. And this one comes out on top, by the way. And you read it and go, oh, wow, I'll have that laptop. Okay, off you go. Done. So you've made this the information. So what you've done is you've made sure that the information enters in the right sequence. You think of it like the tumblers in a lock. First you get the one lock, which is touching, the playing with the device. And then when that's set, you can take the next lock. Now, can't even move the second lock until the first one's been dealt with. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And how do you find out what people's strategies are?
I suppose one way is just to observe them do the behavior in another way. Or you can get them to remember a time when they've done it before and try and elicit the strategy they went through.
Right.
In order to make the decision last time.
Both are getting towards the right point. And essentially, the biggest problem you'll run up against, especially in the second one, is people don't know what their strategies are. You don't know, necessarily, how you buy a computer. You just know that one way feels right and one way doesn't, right? If you've done it a lot, you may have done it so often that you become so sensitized that you kind of figure it out what you need. But very often, we don't know what our strategies are. So we need to have a couple of things happening. First of all, you can sensitize people towards strategies, especially when you start looking towards triggers. A trigger is basically the starting point of a strategy. How do you know that you need to have new shoes, right? What is that trigger? Is something that you see, like your shoes are manky? Is something you feel, like they're getting wet when it's raining? Is something that you hear, other people telling you how horrible your shoes are? How do you know it's time to get new shoes, right? And you won't necessarily know that consciously. But your unconscious knows because, of course, it's running the strategy. So, if I had you physically present, I asked you, how do you know it's time to buy new shoes? Whilst you're considering this, your eyes will go somewhere. And that will tell me. Are you making a picture? Are you talking to yourself? Are you having a feeling? Right? Now I have information of how you start your strategy. If I want you to buy new shoes, and let's say I know that your strategy is visual, there's no point me going on about, you know, your shoes are pretty ugly, they're kind of manky and horrible, and they probably feel bad as well, because you don't care about any of that. If I end up telling you, have a look at those shoes, are those shoes that you, look at them, are those shoes that you really want to be wearing? You look at them and go, actually, no, I didn't notice this before. Now, I have leverage. I can start the strategy rolling. And there's no point in me trying to sell you a shoe or get you to motivate you to buying a shoe until I can get the whole thing going, the whole ball rolling. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Now, for every step on the way, you will get I-axis cues and you'll get descriptions. Always trust the I-axis cues over the descriptions, although file the descriptions as something of interest as well. The other thing that you'll probably need to do is you probably have to ask them about the same event several times, because each time they'll recover more information. So for example, let's say again I want to find out how you know it's time to buy new shoes, and I ask you, how do you know it's time to buy new shoes? I see your eyes going up and you construct a picture, so I know you're constructing a picture. I have no idea what's in that picture yet. And you'll go, I don't know. And go, sure, of course you don't know, but if you were to know, what do you think it might be? Because I don't know. And then you just run through a couple of cycles of that, and each time you sensitize it, and you say something like, maybe, well, you know, if you were to make a picture that tells you it's time to make new shoes, what kind of picture would it be? And it might be you wearing grotty pictures and feeling bad. It might be you wearing brand new shoes and feeling good. It might be you just the shoes on their own looking great. It might be shoes in the shop window. It might be anything. I don't know what it is yet. So at this point, I need to hone you in on the visual element and get you to describe that. And then that will bring something else up, and then I'll hone into that and get you to describe that. And piece, by coming back to the same point over and over and over again, you start to recollect, you start recalling from the unconscious bits of information. At that point, you start developing the strategy, or rather, you start evoking the strategy, you start finding out what it actually is. Make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Now, if you can evoke a strategy that way, surely you can install a strategy in the same way. So if I know that a good way to make decisions about buying shoes is to make a picture, have a feeling, talk to someone, read a review, then, you know, try them on and then buy them, I might run you through that chain in all kinds of different ways, either through hypnotic story or through just visualizing it, just imagining it over and over again, or maybe physically by actually doing it. But whatever way I choose to do this, I can install a strategy by getting you to repeat it until your unconscious mind accepts it or adopts it as a good way of proceeding. This is particularly useful when people have bad strategies that you need to be replaced. So when someone has a problem with something, it's often not good enough to remove the problem. You need to have something in its place. You can't just take the bad strategy away. You've got to have a better strategy in its place. Otherwise, you know, having a bad strategy is probably better than having no strategy at all. So that's something you need to pay attention to. And even if you're not working at the level of strategies with people, you need to pay attention that at the end of what you're doing, there's a strategy in place that is working and that is running smoothly. There's no hiccups on the way. If they have to think about it, then chances are the old problem will come back because it's more automatic than the solution was. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Now, strategies is a big topic, and I may end up spending a whole masterclass on that. For the moment, I think it's enough for you to understand that they exist, how you find them, in other words, through I-axis and cues, and that there's a syntax to them. In other words, there's a sequence that is important. In other words, you know, how pictures, hearing, seeing, feeling something, doing something, that is a sequence. And if you get the sequence in the wrong order, you'll mess up the strategy. You may want to do that on purpose, to scramble a strategy that's not you working for them. And you may not want to do it in terms of when you're installing something new or if you want them to actually get something new. You may just want to do it the proper way instead. So that is the core ideas in terms of the filters. Of course, you'll realize that there are many different filters. There are belief systems, there are metaprograms, there are your personal history and attitudes, etc. These are all different styles of filters, which you can use in terms of how you process information, how you offer information. But the filters I provided now are unique to NLP, pretty much, and are very useful in terms of understanding human interactions. And if you start using them and start playing with them, you may find that your communications become a lot easier, and you understand what people are doing much more fully. In other words, you'll have better information and a better way of evaluating what that information actually means. Make sense?
Yeah, it does. Igor, should you test somebody's I-axis and cues before you start working with strategies? So, for example, if I was speaking to somebody rather than presuming that if they look up to the right, you know, it means that they remember it,
Yes, I got
in
exactly
a
where you're coming
sinister way.
from. I say absolutely yes. Whenever you're working with someone new, the first thing you'll do is always recalibrate. In other words, you want to find out what does this individual do? You never know. There might be one individual up there who has their visual on the bottom. I've never come across someone like that, but it might be possible. You never know. And more importantly, you want to test whether or not they're left or right-handed, and you want to test whether or not that's mapped across onto I-axis and cues. So, absolutely, with every person you meet, you can do it casually by asking about, visual information or information which they have to answer visually and see what happens with their eyes and auditory information and kinesthetic information. So you can do it visually, and you can have a working hypothesis that the person you're going to meet is normally organized, and only if somehow weird things are happening and it just doesn't make sense, that you start saying, okay, maybe I have to go back and revise my initial assumption, and maybe this person isn't normally organized, and I'll do some more careful testing instead. Make sense?
Yeah, it does. So the majority of people that you've met tend to follow the basic rule, do they?
Exactly. And I'd say, especially initially, test everyone they meet anyway, because it's very good for your training. You train yourself to see things that you otherwise would miss. In other words, remember deletion and distortion? You're training your filters to not delete I-axis and cues, so that you become more aware of them, more sensitized to them, and that means they'll be there when you need them. You're just basically making yourself more sensitive to them so that you're more aware of them then. Make sense?
Yeah, it does, thanks.
No worries. Now, let's move on to some of the foundational skills in NLP. What we've done so far is very much based on the conceptual level, the ideas that drive NLP, and there can be some very useful things that come out of that, and we'll investigate that more fully in due course. But let's look at some of the foundational skills. The two core skills that you will need for NLP are known in NLP terminology as rapport and calibration. Let's take those individually. Rapport. What I mean by rapport? Well, it's essentially developing a feeling of mutual trust and comfort. Those are key recipes for any hypnotic process and really for a decent human interaction. If you don't trust the other person, you're not going to share said information or your shields come up. If you feel uncomfortable with the other person, again, your personal defenses, your shields come up, and you're not going to get accurate and valid responses. So rapport is all about how to get people to like you, or at least to trust and feel comfortable around you. And I hope you understand the distinction between liking and feeling trust and comfort. Now, NLP works backwards from something which is quite well documented in mainstream psychology, the idea of matching and mirroring. Essentially, it's this: when two people get on well with each other, in other words, they're in rapport, their body language will tend to be similar. Either it'll match it, so that in other words, when you lift your left hand, they lift their left hand at an appropriate rate and speed. Or they'll be mirroring, which is kind of a mirror image. So if you lift your left hand, they'll lift their right hand at the same rate, speed, and angle. Okay? Now, you can test this for yourself. Go out and to a public place and watch maybe couples or groups interacting with each other. You'll notice things like their head tilt, body tilt, physical gesture, legs crossed and uncrossed. All these things you'll notice, particularly in intimate groups, will be very similar. In other words, they'll either match each other or they'll mirror each other. This is important because NLP has then decided, well, if a result of being in close rapport is this idea of the body matching and mirroring each other unconsciously, well, if we purposely match and mirror each other, well, surely that will increase our levels of rapport with people. In other words, it will fool the other person's unconscious mind into thinking that they have rapport with you. And the theory actually gets proven in fact. In other words, there is nice bits of evidence, there's a lot of studies that show that when you can match people's behavior, as long as it remains at the unconscious level, they will tend to be more persuaded and influenced by you. But here's the key thing: if they consciously realize what you're doing, you go from matching and mirroring, and you leave that territory, and you enter a territory called aping or mimicking. People do not like to be aped. They do not like to be mimicked. They think that you're taking the mickey, that you're somehow making fun of them. They feel uncomfortable when people are mimicking them. And the difference between matching and mirroring and mimicking is basically around the level of subtlety. If you're very crude and they become consciously aware of what you're doing, they will tend to feel insulted. Not everyone does, but most people will tend to feel insulted, and rather than create more rapport, you'll actually destroy whatever rapport you have there. So the key to matching and mirroring is to do it subtly and to do it at such a level that they're not consciously aware of what you're doing. This cuts out most beginners. Why? Because most beginners, they jump around and do it crudely and awkwardly and kind of like a wooden man, so that you can't help but notice. And of course, at that point, they destroy what they're doing. So to help with this, a advancement on matching and mirroring came across, which was the idea of crossover matching and the micro matching, where matching is basically if you lift your left hand to scratch your nose, I lift my left hand to scratch my nose, you tap your pen, I tap my pen. Well, crossover matching is the same idea, but you'd use a different system. So, for example, if you're breathing at a certain rate, I may start blinking at a rate that's equal to your breathing. Now, my blinking and your breathing aren't the same thing, but if I do it for long enough, their unconscious mind realizes, oh, look, there's a pattern emerging that is responding to myself. So I'm having this kind of rapport thing going on. You can do the same thing maybe tapping a pen. So if they're breathing a certain rate, you can tap your pen at a certain rate. If they're tapping their foot, you might tap your finger, or you might tap a pen again, or something like that. So the idea is you take something in their behavior, you choose something in your behavior that is not related to it, but you can equate it just by doing it in the same frequency, the same rate, the same angle, etc. Do you understand the idea of crossover matching?
Yeah.
Micro matching takes the idea of matching and mirroring. You can actually do micro mirroring as well to a different level. So, for example, matching would be if you scratch your left hand and scratch your nose, then I'll lift my left hand and scratch my nose in a hopefully as subtle way as possible. If I do this too often, though, and too directly, you'll notice that I'm aping you and you'll be unhappy. So, what micro matching does is it basically takes portions of someone's motion and matches that. So, it's similar to crossover matching, but you're basically using the same initial motion, you're just using a microscopic version of that. So if you lift your hand a lot and scratch your face or touch your nose, maybe because you have a nervous gesture or something like that, I might repeatedly lift my hand like I'm gesturing. So it's just small motions of my hand coming up off my lap in a small gesture. And that will be the equivalent of coming up and touching my face. So I'm not actually doing the whole motion of coming up and touching my face. I'm doing just a small portion of that motion. And by doing it at the same rate and speed, etc., and frequency that you're doing it, it essentially becomes the same as a matching gesture. The same could be true of leaning. If you lean right all the way forward, I may just lean slightly forward or slightly back. So, those are the idea of crossover matching and micro matching. Now, the easiest way of doing matching and mirroring actually is to do it unconsciously. In other words, to let your unconscious mind take care of it. How do you do this? Well, we use what I call the instant rapport generator. The instant rapport technique, or the instant rapport generator, is based on the fact that when you feel trust and comfort with someone else, you will unconsciously start to match and mirror them. And if you're doing it unconsciously, it's hugely unlikely that they'll ever notice it's happening consciously, because it's happening all the time anyway. So it's much better to let the unconscious mind do it, because it's used to doing it, it knows how to do it subtly, and you won't get caught aping or mimicking, because it would be a very natural motion. How to use the instant rapport technique? Well, the quick version is very simple. Number one, think of a person that you really like. Number two, keep thinking about that person until you feel a certain sensation inside your body. It might be a warm glow in your chest, it might be a comfortable sensation in your belly, but it gives you a feeling that you know feels good. When you're with that other person. The feeling that you get when you're with that other person is the important part. When you get that feeling, then you can dismiss the idea inside your mind and just carry on with your interaction, or you can imagine projecting that feeling onto the other person. Just by doing that, your unconscious mind gets the idea it's time to create rapport with this person, and it will do it. So the simple version is get a picture of someone you like, or think about someone you like, get the feeling, and then project the feeling in whatever way you want to onto the other person, and they'll kind of pick up on it through your BMIRs, your subcommunications. As you're feeling trust and comfort, your BMIRs, remember your behavioral manifestations of an internal representation, will change, and they will pick up on that, and essentially start matching and mirroring them. They pick up on that, and they start relaxing, they start feeling more trust and comfort around you as well. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Now, the next way or level at which you can match and mirror someone is non-physically. What I mean by that? Well, of course, we're talking about tonalities, and we're talking about the actual language that you're using. In terms of tonality, you'll know that people will talk in different rhythms, different volumes. If you match the rhythms and the volumes, so for someone who's very loud and very speaks very quickly, you can speak very loud and very quickly, and it hits a kind of a similar point. But if you know people who are quieter, or maybe who talk a little more slowly, they like to enunciate their words. Well, if you talk more slowly and you enunciate your words, it again has a similar effect. So you're now matching them at the level of tonality. Do you get how that works?
Yeah, sure.